tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. A suicide bomber struck a distribution center for Afghan voters. Identification card Sunday in Kabul, killing at least 48 people, wounding more than 100 others.
According to officials, most of them were waiting in line to receive identity cards.
After I heard a bang, I rushed to the site of the blast, and when I arrived at the scene, we helped many wounded people to carry them to the hospital. All the victims were women and children who were here to get their identity cards.
It's the most serious attack in Kabul since about 100 people were killed in January. Security remains a major problem ahead of upcoming elections.
U.S. President Donald Trump said Sunday the United States has not given up anything ahead of his planned summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. While Pyongyang has already curtailed its nuclear weapons development, but Trump acknowledged that the eventual outcome of his talks with Kim, which could occur in late May or early June, is uncertain, with Pyongyang yet to agree to dismantle its nuclear arsenal and the permanent denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. Several former U.S. presidents were among the hundreds of mourners to pay their respects Saturday to former First Lady Barbara Bush, who died Tuesday at the age of 92. She was the wife of the 41st U.S. President George H.W. Bush and the mother of George W. Bush, the country's 43rd president. China said Sunday it welcomes news that the U.S. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin is considering a trip to Beijing to talk about trade. China's Commerce Ministry said in a statement that the Chinese side has received information that the U.S. side hopes to come to Beijing to discuss economic and trade issues. China welcomes this. Mnuchin said Saturday he is contemplating a visit to China for discussions on issues that have global leaders concerned about a potentially damaging trade war. This is VOA News. A United Nations Relief and Works Agency spokesman says in Syria, the Assad regime continues to use aircraft and artillery to pound districts in the capital held by the Islamic State group. Homes and relief centers have been turned into death camps and many areas are unsafe. Chris Guinness is calling for restraint and urges for the evacuation of the wounded.
We are urging all parties to this conflict to exercise maximum restraint, to spare civilian life, to make sure that civilian infrastructure is not unnecessarily hit. And of course, there must be safe passage for the sick and the wounded and the dying civilians, because it's important now that we spare civilian life. So we need to see maximum restraint and the evacuation of the wounded and civilians who wish to leave the combat zones.
Meanwhile, an international chemical weapons monitor group says that a team of inspectors collected samples Saturday at the site of an alleged gas attack 2 weeks ago in the Syrian town of Douma. Days of protests in Nicaragua over a Social Security overhaul have resulted in the deaths of at least 10 people, including a journalist.
Demonstrators have been protesting against planned Social Security reform since last week. Nicaraguan army troops have been deployed around the mayor's office in the capital, Managua, to protect those offices. The violent demonstrations were triggered by the new Social Security measures, which established an increase in contribution and a deduction of 5% from pensions. I'm Steve Norman, VOA News.
The UN Refugee Agency is appealing to armed groups in southern Libya to allow humanitarian access to thousands of people displaced by fighting to provide urgently needed relief.
Recent deadly clashes between armed groups in and around the southern Libyan city of Saba have forced an estimated 1,900 families or more than 13,000 people to flee their homes. UN refugee spokesman Andre Mihecic says humanitarian help in this region of Libya is desperately needed.
The displaced Libyan population in the south badly needs adequate shelter and basic household items, including hygiene kits, sleeping mats, mattresses, and kitchen sets. To make matters worse, humanitarian access in this part of Libya has been restricted for weeks, and the situation remains extremely volatile. Many have sought refuge in local schools, hospitals, and other public buildings.
Libya has been riven by division and conflict since the 2011 Arab Spring uprising, which toppled former dictator Muammar Gaddafi.
Each year on April 22nd, many people stop to think about the health of the world environment. And like New Year's Day for nature, many make Earth Day resolutions that they treat the world around them more responsibly. This year's Earth Day focuses on getting rid of single-use plastics. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotte in Washington.
If you look at a president that wants to come and rule this country, he should be speaking to the people of Zambia, the people that actually have a right to cast the vote to remove President Edgar Lungu.
Zambian President Edgar Lungu comes under recent criticism over his leadership style.
We don't see the need for that to be happening. But at the same time, we can't say that we disagree with the sentiment. So it's sort of like a bit of a balance between the two positions.
The new Botswana president Mokgweetsi Masisi urges Democratic Republic of Congo's President Joseph Kabila not to seek additional terms in office.
The president will appoint a new minister of foreign affairs, and this is actually will be effective for consultation with the leadership of the National Congress Party.
And the Sudanese president Omar Hassan al-Bashir fires Foreign Minister Ibrahim Gandour. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Zambian President Edgar Lungu has come under recent criticism over his style of leadership. Opponents say he has failed to resolve the economic challenges the country faces in spite of his promises to improve the living conditions of Zambians. They also accuse the president of being unable to weed out corruption. This as the main opposition United Party for National Development, or UPND, moves a motion in parliament seeking to impeach the president. For reaction, I spoke with parliamentarian Alexander Chitemi, who is the Zambian Minister for National Development Planning. As a cabinet minister, you are close to President Edgar Chagwa Lungu. A whole lot of accusations have been made against him that he is incompetent and that he is corrupt, that he is becoming a dictator, and that is why the main opposition party, UPND, United Party for National Development, is moving a motion in parliament to impeach him. What are your thoughts?
First of all, I want to say that the motion is frivolous. I mean, most of the issues that they've brought out are issues that are already before the courts of law in Zambia, and that Parliament in itself has primarily, or I should say initially, rejected the motion, and they reserved a ruling to whether even bring it before the floor of the House. So when you're talking about impeachment, you should come to the House with factual accusations that are, you know, within the Constitution of the Republic of Zambia. But when you look at most of the accusations that are before Parliament to impeach the president are things that are already dealing with the bitterness of the election loss of Hakainde Hichilema. And if you look at that, I mean, it's so African, and that's where we need to move from these African contentious politics where you think that if you've got a bit of popularity, then you're going to be the next president. And if you lose an election for five times, and when you don't have your own internal democracy within your own political party, where you have been head of the political party for more than 5 years, you begin to think and you begin to question your own democracy in a party. So when you lose for five times to a president that was little known, to a president that no one even thought was going to champion and come up as president, it's so bitter that you even have to engage international organizations in your fight to fight the president.
Where do the people of Zambia go from here? Because elections are in 2021, but there appears to be rancor among political party opponents of the president, saying that, you know, he is not fit to run the country. Where do the people of Zambia go from here?
Peter, look at our micros. When you're looking at a country, you need to look at the numbers. Numbers don't lie. Okay, we have enjoyed single-digit inflation figures since the president came into power. We haven't slipped into double digits. Look at our GDP growth projections. We're talking about 4.1 last year's projection. We managed 3.9 going up. We are projecting 5%, 4% in the coming year. We are still maintaining our numbers. So if you're going to talk about a president that has got no vibe, no direction, then we're going to be saying, and we could be together with them saying that we are not going anywhere. But we've got the macros supporting us. So where is it that the president of the Republic of Zambia, Edgar Chagwa Lungu, is missing it, so that these people that are so vipers hungry for power are taking their position. Now, if you look at a president that wants to come and rule this country, he should be speaking to the people of Zambia, the people that actually have a right to cast the vote to remove President Edgar Lungu. But when you see that their voice is the voice of international communities, their voice is going to report into Voice of America, is to see the desperation that a local person has to try and champion his deceit, his hurt, his bitterness, even to the international community, so that now we can create a volcano for the president of the Republic of Zambia, so that we've got international prayer. And, you know, surprisingly, people that we think, that we thought had the credibility to report factual information, like some news agencies in America, have taken up a fight that is not theirs.
Some of them are accusing the president of corruption, and that his promise to fight against corruption is hollow, and that there are no specific measures implemented to weed out corruption as he promised the people of Zambia.
I'm going to take you to one very specific example. The president, when he was making a reshuffle, or when he fired one of his own ministers that he appointed when he was re-elected in 2016, he had made a public statement, and he had said, some of my ministers are corrupt and I'm going to do a purge. And when he did the purge, okay, one of our senior ministers was implicated into the corruption. And he told him, okay, fine, give us time to investigate this corruption. Haven't you seen that he is one of the other prominent people that has voiced out against corruption, saying the president is corrupt? But in the first place, people shouldn't forget that he was fired on allegation that he was corrupt. So when you are speaking corruption, come out in the open and say, okay, fine, we are talking about corruption because we have this and this instance where it is alleged corruption.
One of the accusations I heard was that the government is cracking down on the freedom of speech as guaranteed in the Zambian constitution. And that recently, former Information Minister Kambwili, who is also a member of parliament, a colleague parliamentarian of yours, was brutally kicked out of a radio station because some of his rhetoric was deemed unpleasant by the police, and they kicked him out.
Peter, me talking to you is because I've gotten permission from the party to speak. Chishimba Kambwili still hangs on as a member of the Patriotic Front. And to speak on radio like I'm doing right now, I have to get express permission from the Secretary General of our political party, the Patriotic Front, to speak to you. So I cannot raise up as a minister or as anyone in the party to speak without express permission from the party. And those are the rules. Whether before he was minister, even after he was minister, the rules haven't changed. So if I have to go on a particular radio station or television to speak, I need to get express permission from the Secretary General of the party or from our media director. Now, if you are going to speak on a radio station or a television interview without that express permission, who are you speaking for? Because Honorable Chishimba Kambwili, him, been represented in all those radio stations or TV stations as the member of parliament for Ron on the Copper Belt under the PF ticket, should only get the permission of our Secretary General to go on the radio stations. So he has refused to get acquainted with his own per se political party, which is the NDC. So why is he going to the radio station in the name of the PF?
Now, so let me ask you before we leave, with all these political, what some people will say, cantata, theatrics, whatever you call it, where does it leave the people of Zambia?
You know, I sympathize with our people, because after the election in 2016, politics should take leave and development should continue. But you see the people that have got no heart for the people of Zambia have continued to drag this country into a political landscape that is never ending. When you have an election, then you have a declared winner. It is time for you to sit back and offer alternative solutions to the governance. But what we have now is a continued political barubabu, or whatever it is that you can call it, is just confusion. It's like we are still in campaign mode. Where are we going to have the time to churn out development for the people?
Alexander Chiteme is the Zambian Minister for National Development Planning. He spoke with me from here in Washington, D.C. Thank you. The new Botswana President Mokoiti Masisi has urged Democratic Republic of Congo's President Joseph Kabila not to seek any additional terms in office. In an interview, Masisi said he hopes Kabila will demonstrate real commitment not to attempt to participate in the upcoming elections in December. His remarks came as DRC opposition and civil society groups expressed concern that Kabila plans to seek a referendum to change Congo's constitution to enable him to run for additional terms. For reaction about the new Botswana president's statement, I read Kia Lebo Hadiheto, a Botswana broadcast journalist in the capital, Habaroni.
Generally, Botswana are uncomfortable with our president making pronouncements about any country. But I think we've reached a point where we've more or less figured out that as a country, we don't really like either despots or people who appear to not want to give up power. It's more or less the feeling that as a people we have, really, because we have had so many comfortable transitions here. But is it necessarily a big issue in Botswana? No, it's not, because it's a generally held view here. Though we don't really enjoy it when our presidents or when our leaders have commentary on other countries. We just actually love our splendid isolation. We prefer they didn't say anything. But when they say something that we sort of agree with, like in this case, I think generally it's taken well.
Some people in Botswana said, particularly the opposition said, the country has a lot of problems. It is running out of diamonds. The new president should focus on challenges facing the country instead of, they said, poking his nose where he doesn't belong.
That is generally the view that we would have, that we have enough problems here without commenting. But I think it's a bit of a naive statement. And coming from opposition, it's okay. You know, they just want to say something negative about the guy who's in power. That is fine. But it does represent our sentiment to some extent. But it's sort of naive to think that a sitting president cannot make commentary on a big issue in Africa at the moment. I personally think it's unfair to think that the president would not have an opinion about what is currently happening in Africa, especially DRC, which is proving to be a challenge to SADC at this point in time. I disagree with the opposition, but they're certainly expressing sentiments that are representative of us as Botswana, because we don't see the need for that to be happening. But at the same time, we can't say that we disagree with the sentiment. So it's sort of like a bit of a balance between the two positions.
Kale Boha, some people are suggesting that his statement is akin to statement that the immediate past president, Ian Khama, used to make, and that it appears he's following his footsteps. What are your views about that?
Well, I think as much as we would like to think that Masisi is his own man, he can't possibly be his own man until the general elections. He's inherited a cabinet that, for all intents and purposes, is still very much pro-Khama, very much a Khama sort of administration. He's just holding forth until he wins his own mandate in 2019. So you'd expect him to more or less follow along the lines of what Khama was doing. Without necessarily suggesting that he's not his own man, but it's not surprising. He's trying to find a balance without suggesting that Khama in any way was wrong in doing the things that he's doing. If he had kept quiet, we'd have made a lot of noise and said, no, Masisi disagreed with Khama on this. So he's playing a bit of politics. It's a balancing game. He needs to do things more or less the same way that they were being done under Khama, but at the same time, he still needs to assert himself as an independent sort of person. So I think he's playing politics very well, because, like I said, it's not like he has the full support of his cabinet. He still needs to bring them over to his side, and it's still very much a Khama cabinet. So you'd expect him to make pronouncements from time to time that sort of balance out, that sort of support the positions initially held by Khama.
Do you see any additional political gain with such statement calling on the DRC president not to seek additional terms, which he thinks could cause further problems in that country?
Locally, it doesn't really make any difference. But generally, I bit like the Americans. We get irritated when our leadership get interested in stuff that we feel outside our borders, international stuff. We generally get irritated when our leaders do that. Even if we agree with the position, we generally feel it's not our business really to be poking our noses in other countries' business. So I don't think it will make, not I don't think, I know for a fact it will not make any inroads for him locally. So it makes no difference, to be honest, locally. But I think internationally, if you recall when Mugabe was stepping down and Mnangagwa was getting inaugurated, you know that Khama got quite a huge welcome. Appreciated by Zimbabweans. The general view, whenever I talk to a lot of international African journalists, is that they appreciate that Botswana from time to time breaks the norm and decides to criticize African leaders. They think we need to see more of this going forward. So I think internationally it improves our status, our stature, in Africa, because we generally have a very good appreciation. I mean, we generally get appreciated by a lot of African countries, both the journalists, the pundits, and indeed the population. But locally, it doesn't do much. But internationally, certainly, we come across as a genuinely democratic country that is concerned about the rest of Africa.
Kialebo Hadihetso is a Botswana broadcast journalist. He spoke with me from Habaroni. The Sudanese President Omar Hassan al-Bashir has fired his foreign minister Ibrahim Gandour. This after he signed a presidential decree to dismiss the foreign minister, who is also a leading member of the ruling National Congress Party, or NCP. Gandour's dismissal came after he asked Parliament to intervene to help ensure that Sudanese diplomats are paid, since they have not been paid for the last 7 months. Local media reports that the central bank has yet to raise about $30 million needed to pay the diplomats. For reaction, I reached Dr. Rabi Abdlaiti Obaid, advisor to the communications minister and a prominent member of the ruling NCP in the Sudanese capital, Khartoum.
The embassy has been paid by the president because he actually discussed the information in front of National Assembly, and this information will affect the economy of the country and also distort the image of the country in front of other countries, and this is actually not accepted by him. Whether such information and such, you know, words that disclosed by him can be only for National Congress Party in a closed meeting and not in an open space as he has done. And I think that this is what actually taken against him, and it represents the main reason that led the president to issue this decree to fire him out of Minister of Foreign Affairs.
But isn't it true that for over 7 months, diplomats from Sudan have not been paid? If he called on Parliament to step in to help Sudanese diplomats, what is wrong with it?
You know, this is not the case to be presented in court of the National Assembly, because NPP also, as Ibrahim Gandour, nominated by National Congress Party, the ruling party, this complaint, if there is a complaint like that, should be presented to National Congress Party before actually expressing such information in front of the National Assembly. And I think also Gandour has a firm stance against some action taken by the government. And before 7 months, I think, before a few months, also he submitted his resignation from this post because he considers that some files transferred to some other, institutions and ministries, whereas these files are from the mandate of Minister of Foreign Affairs.
Does that mean that the Central Bank of Sudan is broke and cannot afford $30 million to pay its diplomats? Is your country broke, Dr. Abdlaiti?
You know, if there is a case like that, I think that this case is to be handled by the ministers and council of ministers and other concerned, whether he can complain to the president or to take such case with the Minister of Finance. But it is not a case to be presented in front of National Assembly. As National Assembly is concerned only about the national policies and not about substitution.
But according to the Sudanese constitution, the National Assembly is an arm of the government. You have three branches of the government. Why isn't that a place for him to air his views when the NCP has failed to resolve some of these economic challenges that a country faces?
You know, actually, Ibrahim Gandour is actually a member in the National Congress Party, and he has been appointed in this place as the Minister of Foreign Affairs by the National Congress Party. And I think that if he has such, a complaint or such information which actually affects his diplomat and affects the embassies of Sudan outside, he should handle such information on such case with the leadership of National Congress Party before coming to the National Assembly and saying such information.
So when do you expect the president to possibly name a new foreign minister?
I think that within this week, this week will start on Sunday. And I think maybe within a very short period of time, the president will appoint a new Minister of Foreign Affairs, and this is actually will be a subject for consultation with the leadership of the National Congress Party, so that National Congress Party will accept this nomination of the president. But I don't think that this will take a long time.
Do you think Ibrahim Gandor will be sacked from his position as a prominent member of the NCP because he was also sacked as the foreign minister?
No, I don't think that. I don't think that. This is actually normal decision to be taken by the president, because the president is taking this action as a president of the country and also as the chairman of National Congress Party. And it happens all the time that some people who are representing National Congress Party in the government fired out by the president, but they still enjoying their position and their status in National Congress Party. I don't think that this will happen actually, because we have to distinguish between the role of National Congress Party members and also the role of the minister, because there is no connection between this post and that post.
Dr. Rabi Abdlaiti Obaed is the advisor to the Sudanese Communications Minister and a prominent member of the ruling NCP. He spoke with me from Khartoum. The UN Refugee Agency is appealing to armed groups in southern Libya to allow humanitarian access to thousands of people displaced by fighting to provide urgently needed relief. For VOA, Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Recent deadly clashes between armed groups in and around the southern Libyan city of Saba have forced an estimated 1,900 families, or more than 13,000 people, to flee their homes. UN refugee spokesman Andre Mahecic says humanitarian help in this region of Libya is desperately needed.
The displaced Libyan population in the south badly needs adequate shelter and basic household items, including hygiene kits, sleeping mats, mattresses and kitchen sets. To make matters worse, humanitarian access in this part of Libya has been restricted for weeks, and the situation remains extremely volatile. Many have sought refuge in local schools, hospitals, and other public buildings.
Libya has been riven by division and conflict since the 2011 Arab Spring uprising, which toppled former dictator Muammar Gaddafi. Rival governments and multiple armed factions are keeping the society in a state of perpetual chaos. Tribal fighting is a regular and disruptive occurrence in the region of Saba City, some 760 kilometers south of the capital, Tripoli. Mahecic says the UNHCR was able to seize what he calls a window of opportunity this past week to deliver urgently needed relief items to hundreds of displaced families in the city of Mirzouk. This town, one of the hubs of Libya's modern slave trade, is located about 135 kilometers south of Saba. Conflict has uprooted more than 500,000 people throughout Libya. Mahecic says the UNHCR has increased its resources by 300% in recent months so that it can provide more humanitarian assistance to more people in need. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
It's been a long week. You worked hard. Probably need a break. I can help you with that. I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. This weekend, tune in and relax, energize, connect with great music and great people from across the African continent. This Sunday's 55-minute program features promising young artists on the rise. There's also music news and a feature song of the week from Ghana this time that will keep you current and hip to what's happening on the continent. So join me this Sunday and the following Saturday at 15:05 and 20:05 UTC. Music Time in Africa. Yeah! Thank you.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. But first, Cameroon denies a UNHCR report that it has forcefully repatriated close to 400 Nigerian refugees and asylum seekers since January, but says people running to areas prone to regular attacks by Boko Haram had to be moved to safer locations. For VOA, Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé.
Midjiyawa Bakari, governor of Cameroon's far north region that shares border with Nigeria's Borno state, a former stronghold of Boko Haram, says there have been no forced repatriations of refugees from Cameroon's territory. He says his country has respected standards of the Tripartite Commission that ensures that any repatriation take place safely, with dignity, and ensures durability of returns. The governor, however, says some refugees who settled outside their camp at Minawau, especially in the Logun and Shari administrative unit that is prone to Boko Haram atrocities, had to be moved to safer localities.
Cameroun prendra sur lui la sécurisation des réfugiés du camp.
He says Cameroon made agreements with Nigeria and the UNHCR in a tripartite commission for the voluntary repatriation of Nigerian refugees, and his government will assure their safety until they leave Cameroon. He insists that the repatriation is on a voluntary basis, but that people who escaped to areas prone to Boko Haram attacks had to be moved to safer localities where they could also receive humanitarian assistance from the UN, the government of Cameroon, and well-wishers. Friday, the UNHCR reported that despite warnings, Nigerian refugees and asylum seekers who fled Boko Haram violence had continued to be returned from Cameroon, and underscored the need to provide international protection to those in need. In the report, the UNHCR said that since the beginning of 2018, 385 Nigerian refugees and asylum seekers were forcibly returned from Cameroon, the majority of them last month, including 160 on April 10 and another 118 a week later. The UNHCR said it recognized legitimate national security concerns of states affected by the Boko Haram crisis and stressed that it is important that refugee protection and national security are not seen as being incompatible. There are about 110,000 Nigerian refugees in northern Cameroon. 90,000 are at the Minawawo refugee camp. The UNHCR says 5,000 have arrived since January, when the multinational joint task force of the Lake Chad Basin, comprised of troops from Cameroon, Chad, Nigeria, and Niger, launched attacks on the Sambisa forest, stronghold of the insurgents. Mamadi Fata Kuruma, coordinator of the UNHCR in northern Cameroon, says about 60,000 refugees want to return, and the Tripartite Commission between Cameroon, Nigeria, and UNHCR is assuring that any repatriation takes place in safety and dignity.
C'est presque 30 000 réfugiés qui vivent dans les villages hôtes. Les villages qui les ont accueillis depuis plus de 3 ans, 4 ans.
He says besides the Minawawa refugee camp in northern Cameroon, close to 30,000 refugees have been living in surrounding villages for up to 3 years. UNHCR wishes to help them return on a voluntary basis and assist with dignity in the development of their families, their communities, and their country. He says all returns should be strictly on a voluntary basis and to respect the dignity of the refugees. Cameroon, Nigeria, Chad, and Niger soldiers, under the multinational joint task force of the Lake Chad Basin Commission, announced that they had rolled back Boko Haram's gains last year and said the terrorist group was living its last moments, but warned the insurgency had switched to terror attacks and remains a threat. The conflict that began in northeast Nigeria 8 years ago has left at least 25,000 people dead and forced more than 2.6 million others to flee their homes, according to the United Nations. Cameroon, Chad, Nigeria, and Niger are calling on the displaced population and refugees to voluntarily return to towns and villages, but to be vigilant as the terror group is gradually being eliminated. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Sunday is Earth Day around the world. It's a moment set aside to honor the environment and its teeming life through education about its complexity and fragile beauty and getting into action to save and preserve it. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with the president of the Earth Day Network and looks at how one Peace Corps volunteer is helping to make a difference in the way toxic waste is managed in the Gambia.
Kathleen Rogers is the president of Earth Day Network, a Washington, D.C.-based organization that works with environmental activists and organizations around the world. She says the first Earth Day in 1970 was a relatively small affair, but today over a billion people from 192 countries gather to celebrate Earth Day and commit themselves to a healthy, sustainable planet.
Every year, Earth Day grows and grows. It's the entry point into environmentalism and into the environmental community. And our focus is particularly on the developing world and bringing them both the opportunity to engage in civic life, but also to get something done. It's about science, education, volunteerism, and advocacy. It's those four things.
Action is sorely needed in the Republic of the Gambia, where pollution from non-biodegradable waste, like styrofoam and plastics, as well as poorly managed organic waste, poses severe hazards. Matthew Leffler, a 26-year-old Peace Corps volunteer, is the co-director of Earth Day the Gambia. He's passionate about educating and organizing Gambians about the problems posed by waste.
There's no central system to take care of waste here in the Gambia. Plastics, metals, food waste, human waste, animal waste, electronic waste. People are dumping all their waste in areas that are located right in the heart of the community. There's not a lot of proper dump sites. And the government just doesn't have the resources to create proper dump sites that are far away from communities that are contained. So if you go to the Gambia, you know, in any community, it could be a city, it could be a small village, waste is simply just left on the side of the road or next to a compound, next to a garden, even next to a pump. It's simply just left to rot.
Rotting waste isn't just an eyesore. Children can get very sick from playing in roadside waste piles, and anyone can get sick when they eat animals that have scavenged in waste. Plastic waste releases arsenic, mercury, and other toxins into the soil. But Leffler says the greatest danger in the Gambia may be when waste runoff seeps into the water supply.
The country lives off the river. It's what feeds their crops, and it's for their drinking, bathing, washing, everything. And the water here is very contaminated with waste. Another issue is that it's not good for the land here. A lot of people, they grow their crops, cashews, mangoes, groundnuts, rice, maize. These are sort of how people make their livelihood here in the Gambia. But when you have waste in the land, it can make the land a lot less fertile. And when crops do grow, it can contaminate them.
Leffler and his fellow activists try to show business owners, local vendors, heads of households, and women in their gardens how to manage their waste properly and profitably. He gives one example.
An entrepreneurial organization in the Gambia called Women's Initiative Gambia. Their focus is to empower women to start their own businesses and take initiative. They gave a presentation on ways you can take organic waste and turn it into briquettes, which can be used as charcoal. This is more fuel efficient. It doesn't release as much carbon into the atmosphere. The Women's Initiative Gambia group also showed participants of the training how to make things like handbags or even how to take plastic and metal, and you can melt it. You can actually make tiles that you can put on the ground of your compound, essentially like a driveway.
And Leffler adds that organic waste makes excellent compost for gardens and farmland.
But at the same time, it's going to be good for the environment. That's one of our major goals, is to get some quick wins and sort of show people, you know, how they can actually benefit from their waste in real time from waste management.
Education, of course, holds the key. That's why Leffler is helping to organize several Earth Day events in the Gambia. 2,000 people are expected at a major rally at one mammoth dump site. School groups and youth organizations, local politicians, and environmental activists will participate in a beach cleanup, and a special all-day training session is on offer for select community members who will then teach others. Leffler is delighted by how easily the spirit of Earth Day is catching on in the Gambia.
People really care about their country. They see everybody as brothers and sisters, and they see the land, you know, as their home. So, you know, they want to find ways, you know, to learn. They want to find ways to find solutions that they may have not been introduced to before. Earth Day is going to be very big.
Matthew Leffler, a U.S. Peace Corps volunteer, is co-director of Earth Day the Gambia. It's just one of the partner groups in the planet-wide Earth Day network. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hello, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sport. Kenyan Eliud Kipchoge has won the Virgin Money London Marathon for a third time. Kipchoge, winner in 2015 and 2016, made it a hat-trick of victories in sweltering conditions in London, with Ethiopia's Shura Kitata Tola coming in second. Britain's Mo Farah followed them home with an official time of 2 hours, 6 minutes and 33 seconds in a new British record. The four-time Olympic champion was competing for his first 26.2-mile race since retiring from the track. Kipchoge, regarded as one of the greatest marathon runners of all time, was on course for a new world record but slowed in the final stages of a grueling race in record high temperatures to finish in 2 hours, 4 minutes and 17 seconds. That was 8 seconds outside the record held by his compatriot, Dennis Kimeto. Ethiopia's Tola Shura Kitata finished in a surprise second place, 32 seconds behind Kipchoge. Meanwhile, Kenya's Vivian Cheruiyot won the 2018 London Marathon, but Paula Rodcliffe's mixed gender race world record remained intact. Cheruiyot, who is 34, crossed the finish line in an official personal best of 2 hours, 18 minutes and 31 seconds. That was more than 3 minutes slower than the 2 hours, 15 minutes and 25 seconds a four-time British Olympian Radcliffe ran in 2003. Mary Kaitani and Teronesha Dibaba had been looking to break Radcliffe's record, but both faded. Olympic 5,000-meter champion Cheruiyot ran her first marathon in London last year and finished fourth overall before winning in Frankfurt in the autumn. Kenya's Brigid Kosgei finished second, with Ethiopia's Taladesh Bekele coming in third. Keitani had been on course to break Radcliffe's record, but eventually finished fifth, having lost the lead she had held from the start with around 5 miles remaining. And in football, three former continental champions were placed in the same group in the African Confederation Cup when the draw for this year's group stage was conducted in Cairo on Saturday. ASEC Abidjan from Ivory Coast, AS Vita Club from the DR Congo, and Morocco's Raja Casablanca will play each other in Group A, three teams who have all tested past success in continental competition. They will ensure a tough tussle in the group phase of Africa's football's secondary club competition. Another former continental champion, Enyimba of Nigeria, who won the Champions League back-to-back in 2003 and 2004, played Group C, where their top seeds against CARA Brazil of Congo, Mali's Joliba, and the Ivorians rookies SC Williamsville, a club created in 1995 and who recently named Didier Drogba to their board. Joliba, runners-up 6 years ago, are the only one of this year's 16 group phase participants who have contested a previous Confederation Cup final. USM Alga were paired with three East African clubs in Group D, newcomers Rayon Sport from Rwanda, the regional giants Gor Mahia of Kenya, and the Young Africans of Tanzania. Group B's top seeds are Al Hilal of Sudan, paired with two fellow Arab clubs in Renaissance Bakane of Morocco and Al Masri of Egypt, and the rookies USD Songo from Mozambique. The group phase kicks off on Saturday, May 6th, and there will be a second round of group matches on Wednesday, May 16th, before a hiatus for the World Cup. The last four rounds of group games are set for July and August, after which the two top teams in each group advance to the quarterfinals in September. And finally, in boxing, former two-division world champion Canelo Alvarez has been suspended for 6 months by the Nevada Athletic Commission for two drug test failures in February. Alvarez was forced to pull out of his May 5th mega fight with Gennady Golovkin in Las Vegas as a result of the test failures, which came while he was at home in Mexico. Golovkin will instead face Vanez Matarison on May 5th. However, WBA, WBC, IBF middleweight champion Golovkin will seek an exception from the IBF to sanction his planned fight against the Canelo substitute on May 5th. Meanwhile, it has been confirmed that WBA world welterweight title holder Lucas Matisse will face Manny Pacquiao on July 14th in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. And that's it for this edition of Netherlands Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports, Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
Because Rashida and Nancy. See me whining. Hold on, not talking in bottles. I like to party. Be Shakira and Beyonce from Miami. I like to chill. Chilling with Duse and Jay Z.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under-Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. In the midst of its myriad political, social, and military difficulties, Somalia, the strategically located state in the Horn of Africa, has been resisting efforts to drag it into the Gulf confrontation between the Saudi alliance-led alliance and that of Qatar. The Saudi alliance has accused Qatar of instigating terrorism in the area. Now, as the situation in Somalia has improved, many of the Gulf states have established embassies in Mogadishu, and they are exercising tremendous influence in the country. The same could be said of Turkey, whose president had paid visit stating that it wants to build trade ties with Somalia and also help in the economic development. Now, the United Arab Emirates, which is a part of the Saudi alliance in the Gulf, seem to have made great progress in exercising its influence in Somalia. It has been training the Somali military forces, and recently there were reports that the United Arab Emirates was trying to set up a port in Somalia. This may have worried Qatar, which has been the opponent of the Saudi alliance in the Gulf. It has also been reported that Turkey is wary of the influence of the UAE in Somalia. Then there was a problem which appeared as to why the government of Somalia began to have some question about the role of the UAE. It was reported that $9 million were seized from the UAE plane in Mogadishu. And when that happened, it triggered a response from the UAE. It announced it would end its training program in Somalia. It was the feeling of the UAE that perhaps Qatar and Turkey were involved in putting pressure on Somalia. Now, the matter then turned dangerously. The UAE then turned to the soft underbelly of Somalia. It was announced that the UAE was going to establish a base in Somaliland. This is such an state of Somalia which had not been recognized either by the African Union states or any foreign powers, although it conducts fruitful trade with the Gulf states. Now, anybody who knows the politics of Somalia would know that it is offensive to that country if there is going to be a UAE military base in Somaliland. So this is where the situation stands. There appears to be no mediatory efforts at the moment to ease the tension between the UAE and Somalia. But there is a danger that if Somalia is dragged into the Gulf crisis, it will have serious repercussions, not only in Somalia, but the African states along the Horn of Africa. Djibouti has been able to deal with the strategic location by allowing not only the West to have bases along its shores, having France and the United States, it has also allowed China to have a base in Djibouti. It will be necessary for Somalia to devise a method to accommodate these powers which need Somalia because of its strategic location. But in the meantime, Everyone should commend Somalia by not allowing itself to be dragged into the bitter Gulf confrontation between the Saudi alliance and Qatar. I thank you.
That was one man's point of view, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. And as you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Fraser, Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Nick Ivanov, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, the child of the crab walks sideways like its mother. I'm your host, Peter Clotter in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On April 22nd, more than 190 countries, including the United States, will celebrate Earth Day. It is a day to reflect on the impact humans have on the Earth and to demonstrate and reaffirm our support for environmental protection. The first Earth Day was planned as a teach-in, a day to inform about environmental issues. Earth Day's founder, United States Senator Gaylord Nelson, an environmental activist who was outraged by the lack of political response to gross environmental degradation throughout the country, said that he was convinced that all we need to do to bring an overwhelming insistence of the new generation that we stem the tide of environmental disaster is to present the facts clearly and dramatically. Every university should set aside one day in the school year, the same day across the nation, for the teach-in. His plan worked. Over 20 million people turned up for Senator Nelson's first Earth Day teach-in on April 22, 1970. And from then on, the movement grew spontaneously, creating its own momentum with no central organization. This year, the United States marks Earth Day by highlighting the need to curb the dramatic growth in the world's mismanaged waste and marine debris. Mismanaged waste pollutes the terrestrial environment and flows into our ocean, affecting marine health everywhere. Marine debris, including microplastics in the ocean, can lead to declining global fish stocks and costs billions of dollars to fisheries, tourism, and other industries. The United States is working internationally to encourage technological innovation in the waste sector, to spur new infrastructure investment and private sector engagement, to collaborate in scientific research, to promote market solutions, and to raise public awareness about the threats of unmanaged waste and marine debris. On Earth Day 2018, we celebrate the ingenuity of those who are rising to the many challenges to protect our environment and natural heritage, while promoting economic growth and shared prosperity.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.